It is our final installment of Dig Deep as we take a look at class, and we are looking at the future of class. Chuck Marone is our conservative commentator, Strong Towns, and from Minnesota Brown, it's Aaron Brown. He's our liberal commentator. Do we begin this with class division? That's how we ended it. It's kind of the dangers of class division.
Let me start, and I would like to get to the Trump phenomenon at some point here, because I think it's an important side effect or symptom, or maybe like the warning beacon that's blinking here. That should tell us that something is not going right.
Check engine light.
Yeah, it's a check engine light. Exactly. Thank you. That's a perfect analogy. So you have urban areas in this country, major cities, are in our new globalized economy, in our new technology economy, in an economy that de-emphasizes raw labor. And actually is going so far as to replace, like, even McDonald's workers with robots and computer screens. All of a sudden, what we're finding is that people coming together, it creates far more opportunity and output than people spread out. And so all of a sudden, urban areas where people can mill about, they can meet at coffee shops, they can make business deals, they can have office buildings where different companies are on different floors and you can go back and forth. All of a sudden, that is a huge advantage over just simply spreading people out and building a lot of stuff, which has, you know, been the rural small town competitive advantage for a long, long time. The raw extraction of resources being a rural small town advantage for a long time. And so what we see is that cities are moving ahead. I make a fairly decent wage. My family and I are fairly, do well. If we were to move to the Twin Cities metro area, we would struggle to find good housing. In Brainerd, we can live in a really nice house in a really nice neighborhood. My wife and I both have jobs where we could live anywhere we wanted to. And so what it shows is that if you are able to essentially be part of, in the state of Minnesota, the Twin Cities metropolitan economy, you automatically, even if you're struggling there, you automatically become a step or two up in social class and social standing than if you're at the same kind of place in a rural area, or particularly on the Iron Range, where you're a lot more isolated.
And it's a two-way street, because once you go there and become a part, I've seen this with my friends in my social groups, it becomes hard to come back. It becomes hard to break out of, because if you're paying a mortgage, a high mortgage payment because you bought one of these, my wife watches these House Hunters shows and these real estate shows on the various cable networks, and they'll go to Minneapolis sometimes, and it's not different than a lot of cities. My God, they're going to take out a mortgage for $1 million? Like,
right.
On a house, and one of them is some comical job title that doesn't pay very much. I don't want to pick on anybody, but like, how are they going to do that? Well, okay, maybe they can do that because in their market, they might be able to have jobs that do allow them to pay that mortgage. But how are they ever going to get out of it?
You also have the fact that, you know, I'm a civil engineer. If I want to work in this part of the world, I have like three places I can work. And if I don't do well in one, then the other two are not going to hire me. If I'm down in the Twin Cities metro area, I have lots of job opportunities in different careers and related careers. What you have right now is you have the dynamism of of America that we used to see in rural areas. Rural areas used to be like the dynamic place because we had an economy based on land. Now we have an economy based on ideas, based on interconnectedness, based on largely on technology. And what it has relegated us to is this, I guess, secondary position. I feel like, and I don't want to be like a downer here, but I feel like that is a gap that is only accelerating and only going to continue to accelerate, really.
We've watched, and to again touch on the Trump phenomenon, and just to kind of rehash, I think what a lot of the conventional wisdom is, one of the things we saw was rural places voted for Trump and urban places tended to vote for Clinton. And we also saw the quote-unquote, and this is the term, white working class, poor white Americans voting for Trump in greater numbers than others.
And let me throw out the Democrat line, too. Despite their best interests, right?
Yeah, right, sure. But because,
I think that's an important one for the class discussion.
Yeah, no, because what is your class interest? And is your interest economic in that you'd like to have more money for schools and rural hospitals and rural airports and rural this and rural that? Because obviously Trump has literally proposed getting rid of all of that.
Right. Well, and so, my friends from New York, Aaron, I mean, I have some really good friends from New York City, and they would email me and they would say, Chuck, this guy is a billionaire. Like, they sent me one, the picture of him sitting like with his wife and his kid, and there was like a lion in the room on a throne. Yeah. And they're like, this is your champion of the great unwashed masses? Like, what, are you serious?
Yeah. And that's precisely the thing, is if you look at it from a, just read their plans and look at what's in your economic self-interest. But this was not an election where people did that. This was an election where people had an emotional reaction to attitudes about class and place and culture. And this is where, you know, we can take race, we can take culture, and we can take class and say that there's a Venn diagram there somewhere. They all overlap, but they also have their own little interesting things. And I think there's this idea of, you know, one of the things I've run up to in the debate over, for instance, mining in northern Minnesota, the controversial non-ferrous mining projects, I write about these, and there's always a lively discussion to be had on that topic between people who support or oppose those projects. And one of the lines you see from project supporters is now the most dominant thing you hear is that people from the city, Minneapolis, St. Paul, are out to get us and our way of life. You know, this says, and I always point out, I'm one of these guys, the Logos guys out here trying to say, hey, you know, mine if you want, but consider what the actual job totals are going to be. Consider the fullness of our economic situation and what we can do to become a self-sustaining, supporting community, strong communities. And these mining projects alone won't do it. We need to do more. Okay, this is me, my position, my logical position. Well, it's useless. It's not popular to say things like that. It's popular among certain groups. And I think it's more popular among some of the young people than some of the older people. But if you ask why the Iron Range tilted towards Trump, why Hibbing went red for the first time since Hoover, it's because of the emotional idea that Trump said he would fight for our way of life, which includes, for some people, their race or their class, but certainly their culture. The idea that these rural places or these forgotten places that have no place in this technocratic future of America, that someone powerful and outlandish, in cartoonish even, in their commitment to this, could come in and just do it. And that's the emotional, visceral reaction to Trump that I think carried the day. And it doesn't matter. You can run ads about what he said about the gold lion, and you can do any of that, and it's all impervious because it becomes a question of who says they're on our side and who says that we need to go to school and get a job that pays $30,000 a year.
That's Aaron Brown. You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio, whether it's on air, on our website, or podcasted. Go to kexe.org to find out more. They're talking about the current times, class, and the future of class in northern Minnesota. Chuck Marone continues.
One of the books of the year last year was Hillbilly Elegy, which I read. And to me, I felt like it was a book that liberals liked, because it brought the dysfunction of rural areas. It created this big personification of that. And I think a more challenging book would be Arlie Rothschild's Strangers in Their Own Land. Here's a professor from Berkeley University who goes to the reddest of red parts of Louisiana and essentially embeds herself, lives with people, not as a way to report on their dysfunction, but to actually, what she calls it, build an empathy bridge and try to understand their values and why they believe what they believe. And one of the, I think, most striking passages in that book, she's with this guy who is out on a lake, and he's distraught because the company has dumped chemicals into the lake and killed all the fish and killed all the trees and flooded all this area and made his way of life, the things that he loved about living there, diminished. And she said, why don't you support policies of environmental regulation? Why don't you support government coming in and require them to pay decent wages and clean up their stuff? And why don't you support this? This seems logical. And he said, you know, I've seen all those laws. What happens is that I go out and I accidentally shoot the wrong bird and I get fined. They poison all the birds and nothing happens to them. They got lawyers and they can buy people off. I go out and my gas can leaks out the back of my boat. I get fined. They pollute the whole lake and they got lawyers and lobbyists and they can get around that. It was so striking because what it talked about is this disconnect. For rural areas, there's this sense that the system is not working for us. And 50 years ago, it was a system designed by us for us. And I think one of the things that made Trump so potent was that he attacked the trinity of globalization, free trade, and immigration, which, whether those are real issues or not, and I think intellectually you can debate them, is very easy to draw a simplistic narrative around those things to people that are seeing their fortunes not rise with the rest of the country.
I think that idea that the system is fixed, you know, a lot of people who voted for Trump didn't even necessarily like him. Some people really, really did, don't get me wrong. But they liked the idea. This is just people I know from northern Minnesota, people who may have switched from Democrat to Republican this last election. They liked the idea of sending Trump like a Trojan horse of chaos into the palace.
It's funny because I did not vote for Trump, but there was a part of me that there was that primordial part of me that was like, yeah, chaos machine. Let's actually shake this thing up a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly kind of what people were hoping would happen. And indeed, they're getting what they wanted, which is why you see that his base of supporters tends to be sticking with him despite all, you know, is he saying something crazy about foreign policy? Well, he did that in the campaign. Is he picking on people, saying mean things about groups of people? Well, sure, because he did that in the campaign too. None of this is shocking to the people who sent him there because he's doing what they expected. Is it good for the country? Me sitting here, of course, I was appalled by all those things that he said, and I was appalled by what he represents to a country that I think, despite its flaws, is still people voting and trying to accomplish something. I found all of that horribly offensive, and so I had no trouble not voting for him, and I had no trouble with the flaws of any given candidate who ran against him, compared to the idea of it. But for a lot of people who are not sitting where I sit, they don't feel that same way at all. And that was interesting for me, because I didn't expect that. Normally you think your world is the world and everybody else's world is just like yours. And this is what I think is happening in America, why there are so many disconnects in this last election and why the next few are going to be just as nutty, I think, is we're all living in different realities.
I do think that this class distinction is the critical one. And I actually see it continuing to accelerate as we move forward into this crazy, you know, world of technology. You have people actually talking about artificial intelligence and the ability to get brain implants that will help you cognitively. This seems like a crazy notion, but it's only slightly less crazy than having a phone that has more information on it than an encyclopedia. You know, so the idea that you could get a little chip that would help, you know, you process a little more quickly, whether it's an autonomous car, you can see like this whole line of things that actually start to separate the people who can access it from the people who don't in ways that go beyond just, you know, mere class. If all of a sudden we create, and this is going to sound spectacular to people, but there's actually a legitimate conversation out there. If we can create a race of superhumans who have the capacity to think better, you look at like the way we were in the 1700s and classifying a whole groups of people as waste people. What does that do to our conversation? You know, when your cognitive ability, when your IQ goes from 120 to 200, and you look down at these, you know, today the unwashed masses out here in rural America who just don't get globalization and just don't get free trade and are just too racist to understand immigration. Now all of a sudden you take the people who are already in an upper class and supercharge them. What does that do to our conversation then? And I feel this tension because I live here. I mean, these are my places. These are my people. And I've said this before on this show. I felt like the call of Trump. I didn't vote for Trump. I also didn't vote for Clinton, just for the record. But I felt the call because I do feel like people are getting left behind. And it's not people who are opting out of the system. It's people who are being forced out of the system. Essentially, the system is being wired for people who are in major cities, go to major universities, are part of the Ivy League system. We've reestablished, in a sense, that aristocracy that says, if you can check off these boxes, the future's wired for you. And oh yeah, you know, we'll sit and lament and read Hillbilly Elegy and feel bad for people who are, you know, but my gosh, not those rural people. They're ignorant, you know, racists. And so forget them.
Right. And that saying that instantly sends people further into where they're going to go anyway, into where they feel comfortable and why I won't say the policy doesn't matter. People can engage with the policy, but what their priorities are, I think is, and politics is so much of, some of it's policy, a lot of it is priorities. What's the most important thing you can do next? And when it becomes essentially a culture war, just don't be the other side. In fact, make the other side pay. When that becomes the kind of what people think about when they go to the ballot box, then you're going to get a more punitive and a more divisive result. And so what we talk about the class of the future and where this is going, I think one of the outcomes is really scary. I read another book called The Time Machine by Jules Verne, the Eloi and the Morlocks, and how thousands of years in the future, there will be a whole underclass of people that's now evolved into a totally different species. And then the upper class has a life of leisure above ground in the bright sunlight. The only thing is they've been conditioned to realize that periodically those Morlocks are going to come up and maybe take one of them. And so this is the side effect of living, and everybody's okay with it. You know, the Morlocks are fine down there making everything work at the industrial works down below the earth, but periodically they taste Eloi flesh. That is the trade. Now, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but what I'm saying is that this idea of there being one small group of people that have the money and resources and one much larger group of people that does everything unpleasant and gets none of the rewards for it, or very little of the rewards for it, other than passing pleasures. That is tricky, that is dangerous, and I don't think we have to look at human history very long to find why that ends up being bad for everybody in the end. I mean, we were talking in the previous segment about World War I, and I often wonder, you mentioned it was the aristocratic war where the powerful people of Europe fought these old feuds to determine the new power structure.
But at the beginning. Right. By the end, the Kaiser was gone, the Tsar was gone.
Right. But by the end, you had the rise of the red revolutions in countries all over Europe, and the Russian army just marched off the battlefield because it had its October Revolution. And so you have to wonder if those aristocrats who started the war, or who certainly fed its flames, didn't realize too late that had they not gone that route, they might have kept their jobs, or it might have been better for everybody. Because in the end, ultimately, the rise of socialism in Russia didn't necessarily deliver the goods for its people either.
I think as a transition to thinking about what we should do, that's a really good one. Because I do think the path we're on is inevitably going to lead to greater class conflict. And it has historically led to revolution. I feel like the thing we need to do is not a redistributed policy I could be talked into a basic minimum income, which we've mentioned on the show before. There's federal policies that we could do, but I think at the end of the day, what we really need to do is we need to make our cities and towns, we need to make our rural areas stronger. We need to make them more self-sufficient. We need to make them less dependent on, in our case, you know, what happens in St. Paul and Washington, D.C., and more dependent on what happens at the Hibbing City Hall and the Grand Rapids City Hall. We actually need to open up job opportunities here to start the donut shop, instead of essentially creating an economic system that subsidizes the Dunkin' Donuts into existence and then sucks money out of this region. I think we need to start changing an urban top-down economic system into a very bottom-up one that will have strong urban areas that are prosperous, but will also have strong cities and towns and neighborhoods spread out throughout the state. So we can all kind of stand on our own two feet and look each other as equals, which is really, to me, for all the social justice warriors and all the talk of equality, to me, that's where you start to break down class, when we all can stand on our own two feet and look at each other as self-sufficient equals. Now I think we're starting to get to a more just society, even if there are class differences in that.
And I think it's one of the areas where, Chuck, you and I have come to agree so much on the what the priority should be, which is rebuilding these communities and getting them to function in a healthy way, in a self-supporting way. Because whether you're relying on a corporation that may or may not open a big mine on the edge of your town 5 or 10 years from now, or whether you're relying on a federal grant or a policy change or a new governor or whatever the political outcome or the corporate outcome, you will wait maybe forever for some of those things to happen, or you'll always be up and down, two steps forward, three steps back with the next change in regime. But if you can rely on each other and grow within your community, no matter what's happening in the outside world, then you're talking about something. It's an area, I think, where liberals and conservatives, but certainly rural and urban and different classes can find agreement, is, hey, let's live in a good place. Let's live in a good town. And I think this is the values that I think more people share than things, all the other issues where they disagree.
There, I heard some hope there at the end.
We had to find some, and that's where I think that's about it. Because if we go down the road we're going, I think we're going to a very dangerous place.
Yeah, I think we're priming ourselves for a time where Trump looks nice.
At least Trump is unable to do much.
Yeah, imagine if you had a Trump that actually was effective. You had Trump with like Nixon savvy. I mean, that's a completely different entity. And I do think that that is what we're priming for, unless we start to empower people in communities. And by the way, my critique there is a critique of the top down, which is a Democrat kind of philosophy, although when Republicans are unable to give that up either from a governing standpoint. But I think philosophically, what I would like to see us get back to is actually having communities where people work together on stuff instead of this kind of, if we want to say big government, big corporation, big, top down, try to solve the problem. We were able to try that for a long time because we had tons of money. We don't have the money to just throw around anymore. We got to do it from the bottom up. And I think the quicker we realize that, the quicker we'll put all of our current waste people to productive work, building their own futures.
The most hopeful political stories I've read in the last 2 years have all come from communities, cities or small towns.
Amen.
Not from states or the federal government. And that's, as a guy who's as a Federalist, it's just so depressing to watch people unable to decide whether they want federalism or Jeffersonian politics. And so they can't decide. So it comes down to the communities.
We want you to weigh in on class. You can send us an email, comments at kaxe.org. It's Dig Deep. Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator of Strong Towns, and Aaron Brown, Minnesota Brown, our liberal commentator. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, you missed the fist bump. Radio audience. The radio audience missed the fist bump.
But what? They might have heard the psst.
That was me. That was me. Sorry about that.
We have to come up with a topic where we just hate each other on.
I know.
Well,
you know?
We can dig it up, I'm sure.
Because I feel like Aaron and I are just predisposed to want to find areas where we agree on because we like each other.
I don't want to make Chuck cry.
Yeah. No, I think this is a better way.
Dig Deep is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. Don't forget to sign up for our Dig Deep podcast or listen online, kaxe.org. You can give us feedback or give us topic suggestions for Dig Deep. Send an email to comments@kaxe.org.